We're here for Zoom oral argument in our second case of the morning, RTI Restoration Technologies, Inc. v. International Painters and Allied Trades Industry Pension Fund, case number 24-2874. Would counsel for appellant please formally introduce himself and then make a request for how much time you'd like to reserve for rebuttal?
May it please the court, Brian Apicelli on behalf of the International Painters and Allied Trade Industry Pension Fund. If I may, please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yep, that's granted. You may start.
All right. This is a withdrawal liability dispute in which the district court invalidated an $800,000 assessment on the grounds that the pension fund failed to assess the plaintiffs for the withdrawal liability as soon as practicable under section 1399. And with all due respect to the district court, it should not have waded into that issue because this issue is subject to arbitration, which the plaintiffs admittedly did not initiate and which they have therefore waived.
Counsel, I have a question. You concede, do you not, that the plaintiffs could sue for summary judgment in district court based on the contention that they're not an employer? You have basically conceded that, have you not?
That's correct.
Okay, so when the district court is presented with that issue and another issue is raised about the notice, what is it that bars the district court from determining the as soon as practical issue? What is the case that says, and by the way, if the district court has this before it, it cannot decide this as soon as practical issue? Because as I read Dorns and Kodrian and Centric, it seems to me that if this is before the court, it is not an abuse of discretion, or the court lacks jurisdiction, if you will, to decide that issue. So tell me your best case for this, especially after Allied. What's your best case for the proposition that the district court in this fact pattern is barred from deciding that issue?
Well, to be clear, the district court did have jurisdiction to consider it. We are not saying that there was not jurisdiction. This court's case law makes that clear. But in the Crown Court case, this court also says that to ignore this plain arbitration mandate would leave the arbitrability of these disputes to the discretion of district court judges, which is a result Congress plainly did not intend in mandating that disputes involving sections 1381 through 1399 shall be submitted to arbitration in the first instance.
But this is not a dispute regarding a determination made under 1381 to 1389. This is not a dispute regarding that determination. This is a different dispute regarding an element of the claim. There isn't, under Allied, a claim doesn't even arise. You don't even have a claim, you know, regarding the determination unless these three things have occurred. So I guess, I mean, Crown Court is the case you're relying on. I don't think it's opposite.
Well, there's other cases too, Your Honor. So Barker and Williamson specifically states that yes, a company in plaintiff's shoes may initiate or may raise this employer challenge in federal court, but doing so does not suspend the deadline by which it must initiate arbitration. And so if you fail to follow the statutory procedure by separately initiating arbitration with respect to issues that are within the scope of section 1401, then you will have waived them if you lose on that employer issue. And in Allied Painting case, yes, that case did involve the same section 1399 challenge by the employer there and by the plaintiffs here. The difference between these two cases is that the employer and Allied followed the statutory process of submitting it to arbitration in the first place. That is why this court was reviewing factual findings by an arbitrator on appeal. And that case came down 2 years after the plaintiffs in this case have already waived arbitration with respect to this 1399 challenge. In Huber, this court separately sent to arbitration an issue regarding whether or not the pension fund had the power to assess, send a second assessment under section 1399 because it went to arbitrable procedure and the validity of the assessment. That is the same thing here. If we did not assess as soon as practicable, then that could call into question the validity of the assessment under Allied. But for the plaintiffs to properly preserve that issue, they have to initiate it through arbitration within the statutory period, or else they waive it. That is the ruling specifically from the Eighth Circuit in the Vaughn case that has been consistently followed throughout these cases, that if the plaintiffs want to complain about the pension fund's lack of diligence, they must themselves show diligence by preserving this claim. And they did not even file their claim in the federal court until after this arbitration issue had been waived.
So I guess let me just tease out a little more on Judge Rendell's question here, because it seems that we all know that persons in the plaintiff's shoes could come in and say, hi, we don't think we belong in arbitration. They can come to federal court and say, we don't think we belong in arbitration because we aren't even an employer. And so they certainly did that. But what you, and then it's natural, I think, for them to say, oh, and include the even if argument. Oh, even if we were an employer, then it wasn't as soon as practicable. And what Judge Rendell is pushing you on, what you're resisting is, yeah, you can do the first part, no problem. Everyone does the first part. But don't even think about doing the even if tag along. No, so you want a rule of law that says, despite the practicality, despite the futility maybe of sending it to arbitration, I don't know if that's an issue in this case, but we do have summary judgment on that. But despite all of those things, the rule of law that you're submitting is no even if arguments are allowed. Do I have that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And it's not just the rule I'm submitting, it's the rule that this court has submitted in Barker and Williamson, and also the 1992 Centra decision, in which the company in that case challenged within the statutory period the pension fund's claim that they were employers, and then separately they initiated arbitration with respect to all other challenges, and the court in that case specifically said yes, they had to follow this process in order to preserve all those other challenges other than the employer issue.
But how about in public industries, where just Judge Aldersert, writing for our court, said the policy justification that supports exhaustion through arbitration would not be furthered by postponing judicial review of the matter before the court, which is constitutional to the MEPA. The law should never command a litigant to perform a useless action. Ordering immediate consideration will not dilute the efficacy of the exhaustion doctrine. Isn't that what we're presented with here? You know, clearly in Allied, we said, yo, you have to do this notice requirement. And here, and it's an element. And here it didn't happen. Why are we going through some kind of, you know, why are we trying to jump through hoops and say, oh, arbitration, when the court clearly was presented by exactly what Allied had to say?
Your Honor, Barker and Williamson specifically addresses that passage of Republic Industries that you're referencing. And they say that this situation in this case regarding an employer, employer's mere contention, or a company's mere contention that they are not an employer, does not rise to the level of a constitutional attack in which you would have to arbitrate something that you believe is unconstitutional. It distinguished between that situation, and it also pointed out that the company's argument in that case was an especially poor basis to raise that, because by the time that the company had raised its employer challenge, arbitration had already been waived. That is the fact pattern of this case. Arbitration had to be demanded in January of 2022. They did not file, they never initiated arbitration, and they did not file their complaint in this case until April of 2022, 92 days later.
But are you expanding on what the arbitration provision says? It says disputes as to the determination made. This is not a dispute as to the determination. And the case law says, you know, and I think in Republic, we said it had to do with the disputes over the amount has to be arbitrated. That's not what we have.
No, Your Honor. The determination could be made by the pension fund, or it could be made by the plaintiffs in this case, because it does not say determined by the pension fund. And if you go down a couple of statutory sections below, when we're talking about presumptions of correctness, there's a presumption of correctness with respect to determinations made by the plan. So
I thought that was only with respect to unfunded vested benefits. Is there another one?
No, it's any determination involving the subsections 1381 through 1399 and plus 1405, which is a calculational issue. But factual determinations regarding that. So, for example, factual determination regarding Section 1392, that there has been an evader of a transaction, the fund would be entitled to a presumption of correctness regarding that. But what I'm pointing out is the difference in the statutory language that should mean something here, because determination under 1401, that is very broad language. It applies to both parties. It includes no exceptions. It does not distinguish between things that go to the merits versus things that go to procedure, as the plaintiffs have asserted. It simply applies to this case. And this court has applied that to
other. So just let me tease out who, in this instance, who made the determination and how did they make the determination that the notice was sent as soon as practical?
So the pension fund sent out the assessment. And then in response to that assessment, the plaintiffs requested review, raising various calculational issues. They did that on September 24th, 2021 at Supplemental Appendix 18 to 20. And then the fund responded to that request for review in November.
So as I'm looking at it, the phrase comes up as I read this is I'm sure you're familiar with this 1399B1, but it says as soon as practicable, after an employer's complete or partial withdrawal, the plan sponsor shall, and then there's two subsections. The first one says notify the employer of, and it's amount of liability or schedule of liability payments, and then the next one is demand payment in accordance with the schedule. And so it seems that the things a plan sponsor has to do are notify the employer and demand payment. That's what as soon as practicable comes. So who made the determination that the notification was as soon as practicable or the demand of payment was as soon as practicable, at least under this schema for evaluating that subsection?
Well, by sending the letter, the fund had determined that it was within that as soon as practicable condition. And if the plaintiffs wanted to challenge that, they would have had to raise it through arbitration within the statutory deadline. And if they don't raise it, then it is waived by virtue of Section 1401B1, which states failure to initiate arbitration within this deadline shall result in the amounts claimed in the settlement
becoming due and owing. So if I understand your position, it's that implicit in the notice and implicit in the demand is a determination that they're being made as soon as practicable?
Yes, and also there was a determination made by the plaintiffs in this case that it was not sent to them as soon as practicable under Section 1399, because at some point after we were well into this case on the single employer issue, they raised that for the first time after the issue had already been waived by not submitting it to arbitration.
Well, isn't that at odds with what Allied said about the as soon as practicable issue?
No, because Allied was reviewing a factual determination by an arbitrator in which the fund disputed in that case that the notice was not sent as soon as practicable. The arbitrator ruled against the fund, but then ultimately still entered the award in favor of the fund because of the prejudice issue, which this court and Allied ultimately said, we're not going to consider prejudice, right? So that is different. The issue was submitted to an arbitrator issued a final award, and then this percolated through the process that is specified in the statute. And so I would just direct the court also to the First Circuit's Giroux decision, where that was an interim payments case when it was on appeal, but there was a separate arbitration issue regarding a 12-year delay in issuance of the assessment. The arbitrator, during the course of the oral arguments in that case, ultimately said that this is not going to be invalidated for failure to assess as soon as practicable. And the court in that case said, we're not going to review that issue right now, and we're going to make them follow the statutory process of appealing that arbitration award through the district court first, and then to this court, notwithstanding that it may be quicker in this case for judicial economy, we're going to stick to the scheme that Congress enacted. And okay. Alan Cain cited that case in its footnote 17, as well as the Joyce case, saying that these are to be raised at arbitration, as does Bay Area Laundry. And I know it was dicta, but Justice Ginsburg, in the unanimous opinion, said this may be asserted at an arbitration. She said last.
Well, that's missive. Yes, of course it may be. It may be asserted in, maybe she'd say it may be also be asserted in district court. That's not dispositive. No, let me ask you a question. You would like this to go back to the district court for a finding regarding employer status. And if indeed the fund is, I mean, these plaintiffs are employers, they would be barred from contesting the notice because of the passage of time.
Absolutely. That's the rule that flows directly from Barker and Williamson and this court's decision in Centra, as well as many other circuit courts that this court would be splitting from if it did not follow that well-established process.
But, But those cases are cases in which the determination was made and then the employer didn't do anything and the fund sued and the employer was held to have been, the employer was held to have been barred to raise because once they were served with the determination, they should have known because there was no issue as to whether they were an employer. Here we have a different situation. There's a genuine issue about whether they're... Anyway, I wanted to get your argument.
Judge Rendell, just to be clear, the Eighth Circuit Vaughn decision involved the threshold issue of whether those companies were employers within the meaning of the statute under a control group theory. Here the theory is successor liability mainly or alter ego or single employer. It's the same thing. In federal court, they challenged their employer status, and then because they were deemed to be employers, they ultimately waive that other Section 1399 challenge because they did not timely initiate arbitration with respect to it.
But they didn't have Allied as their precedent. Allied is a very, it's an unusual case.
But Allied basically said that the fund must follow a statutory requirement, right? And
absolutely.
Allied did not say that the employer can get the benefit of this if it disregards a different mandatory provision, right? And there's an order of operations. If they don't timely initiate arbitration, then the amounts claimed shall become due and owing as a matter of law.
So what exactly is the regime that you see following from this? Do you see like prophylactic arbitration requests by entities that say, hey, we aren't an employer. We really don't even belong in arbitration. The last place we belong is arbitration because we aren't an employer, but we don't want to lose our rights to challenge as soon as practicable. So we're going to file a prophylactic arbitration demand, and then we're going to go to district court on a DJ action. Is that the sort of kind of litigate the case in two fora approach that you're advocating?
Well, file the case in two fora and then seek a stay of the arbitration as was done in Centra. And you don't necessarily have to ask the district court for a stay of that proceedings, because if they would have asked us to stay the arbitration, we have no interest in arbitrating an issue that was not even raised in there. We would have agreed to the stay. We've agreed to that in other cases, right? And we would have agreed to it here. And the arbitrator also has independent discretion. I cite all these different cases and footnotes, and I believe my reply brief, there's a 10th Circuit case that says the arbitrator has discretion to stay. But yes, ultimately, to reserve it, but then we don't necessarily have to do anything on it until we have this threshold issue, because it would be inefficient for us to go through an arbitration only to lose in the district court because these guys aren't employers, and then say, well, the assessment's invalid anyways. And by the way, as soon as practicable, that provision only applies to employers, right? So if they're not an employer, then it doesn't apply. It only applies if they are employers, which they dispute. So why would they get the benefit of a provision that doesn't apply to them under their own theory?
But district courts routinely do an alternative theory, even if, I mean, it's almost lacking in judicial economy to not address something like that. And you want us to say the district court abused its discretion.
I want you to follow the court's earlier decisions in which it says that we will not suspend this arbitration deadline merely because it might promote judicial economy, when Congress has been very clear that this is to be decided by an arbitrator in the first instance. Jurisdictions are red herring. There's a statute.
Okay. All right. We're over time right now. I think maybe any other thoughts you have on this, you reserved your 3 minutes for rebuttal. You can think how you want to conceptualize those for us on rebuttal, but now we're going to turn it over to your friend on the other side. Please introduce yourself and we'd like to hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Eric Magnelli. I represent the appellees in this matter, RTI Restoration Technologies, Inc. and Industrial Maintenance Industries, LLC. And the district court had every right to determine that a pension fund did not assess and demand withdrawal liability as soon as practically, especially when the party being assessed is indisputably not an employer and not part of a control group. I want to go out of my original order and address the issue that's been discussed at length right now, and that's the determination language. Section 14, any dispute between an employer and the plan concerning a determination made under 1381 through 1389 shall be resolved through arbitration. And that language, determination, is very important because it does not say concerning sections 1381 to 1399. And if you look at the statutory language. And as the pension fund has argued, let's look at the plain language of the statute. If you look at the plain language of all the statutes between 1381 to 1399, every time the word determination is used, goes to the calculation of withdrawal liability. Now, that has been expanded a little bit through precedent that the determination goes towards the demand for withdrawal liability. It goes towards the date of withdrawal liability, and it goes towards the calculation of withdrawal liability, because the determination has to do with the amount. And why? Because district courts don't want to deal with fights about how something was calculated. And there is a presumption of reasonableness for the calculation. There is no presumption of reasonableness for whether or not a pension fund acted as soon as practicable. That is an independent statutory requirement. That is not a presumption that they make.
It's one, though, that is, it is one that in the statute is expressly linked to the phrase demand. And if demand constitutes a determination based on our case law, as soon as practicable, expressly links itself to a demand, doesn't that also constitute a determination?
No, it does not, Your Honor, respectfully, because what the demand is, where the determination and demand fall to place, has to do with the fact that they made a determination that the fund withdrew. Then they made a determination of the amount. But there is no language that they need to determine when the assessment goes out. That language just is not into the statute. And if you look at precedent, Third Circuit precedent, all the way from Flying Tiger from the 80s, all the way to Allied now, as early as the 1980s, Flying Tiger stated that the MPPAA provisions that are explicitly designated for arbitration, they have to fall within the purview of the MPA provisions.
Counselor, what do you say of Barker versus Williamson that your opponent seems to be relying so greatly on?
Yes, well, Barker and Williamson is really not applicable, Your Honor, because Barker and Williamson, the issue was whether a member of a control group had constructive notice. That had nothing to do with whether or not something was issued as soon as practicable. That was the issue in that case. And they're a control group member and an employer are different than alleged successors and alter egos, because an alleged successor, an alleged alter ego, is not a contributing employer and is not a member of a control group. So they cannot be compelled to arbitration, because an arbitration doesn't have any an arbitrator does not have jurisdiction unless and until that entity is determined to be an employer. So Barker and Williamson is just not applicable at all.
Well, I'm assuming, and I have to go back and look at that case, but I'm assuming that that case arose in arbitration, and the question is, was that issue was raised? But does anything in Barker and Williamson prohibit a court from deciding an issue regarding notice as soon as practicable?
No, and I have not seen a single case within the Third Circuit that addresses that issue in any way, shape, or form. Every case that the fund relies upon has to deal with employers or control group members who either initiated arbitration or decided not to initiate arbitration. None of those cases deal with situations that we have today, which is whether someone is a successor or an alter ego, because they are not employers. They are not members of a control group, and successors and alter egos are not even addressed in the statute itself. It was created by common law.
So I guess your position, though, seems to suggest that there would at least be, even to your position, there'd be a magic words exception. If in demanding payment in accordance with the schedule, the fund says, and we've made the determination that this demand was made as soon as practicable, then it seems that you've got a determination that fits within the statutory subsections. And so they've told you, yeah, we're actually making this as soon as practicable. We're the best people to make it, because we know how practical things were on our end. It's not your end. It's our end that matters, that defines practicality. And so if they would have said that, the determination issue would be solved. If they said, oh, yeah, we're demanding this, or we're notifying you of this, and we determine that we're doing so as soon as practicable, then then that's just that they've locked you up, haven't they?
Not at all, Your Honor, because they can't expand the statute to provide them with a power that the statute does not provide them. Nowhere in the statute does, or case law for that matter, says that a pension fund makes the determination as to what is or is not as soon as practicable. And now that we have Allied said that is an independent statutory requirement. Allied did not say that it is that the pension fund determines what is or is not as soon as practicable, and then you, employer or alleged employer, need to rebut that presumption by saying it's either unreasonable or clearly erroneous. That in Allied, that was a finding that the arbitrator made against a, I don't remember if it was an employer or a control group member, but that was a determination that the arbitrator made. It wasn't a burden that the employer had to overcome. And even in this case, IUPAT filed a counterclaim to collect withdrawal liability. And on summary judgment, the district court ruled that they did not meet an element of their claim, which is to assess, notify, and demand as soon as practical. And as a result, the district court dismissed their case. There was never a motion to compel arbitration. There was never any sort of argument that the district court lacked jurisdiction. In fact, the district court clearly had jurisdiction because there was a counterclaim to collect withdrawal liability, and the district court determined that. But there has never been a case interpreting any of these statutes that stands for a proposition that a pension fund makes the determination of what is or is not as soon as practical.
But you agree, though, that as soon as practical can be decided in arbitration, right?
Of course. Yes, it absolutely
can. And so are there any other issues that can be decided in arbitration where there's case law that says, yeah, you even though it can be decided in arbitration, we're fine with you coming to a district court first?
Yes. So, for instance, there is in prior cases in this circuit has determined that it will not overexpand the arbitration requirements outside of the technical requirements of calculating. And if we look at
Dorns and Coulter-Yan.
Yeah, Coulter-Yan, it would not expand it. It would not expand arbitration for questions of fraudulent inducement to join a pension fund or misrepresentation in Centra.
But I know that. But my question is, aren't those cases where they said, don't bring this to arbitration? This isn't subject to arbitration. I'm asking where we take it as a given, where you say, yes, this can be raised in arbitration. Do we have a single case that says something that can be raised in arbitration can also be raised kind of de novo or first crack in district court? And I kind of get the sense that you know, whether it's articulated or not, the answer seems to be, if it can be raised in arbitration, I don't see too much case law where a court says, yeah, and we'll take it up first crack as well.
I think I agree with what you're saying, Your Honor. I haven't seen a case where it said you cannot raise this in arbitration other than employer status. Yes, when a control group member or when an employer initiates arbitration, as they should do, as the statute requires for the technical requirements, it makes sense. It makes sense. You're in one forum, fight it out in arbitration. You're allowed to. I mean, who wants to fight on two forums if they don't have to? So yes, as long as you're not talking about an employer status, they can, or fraud or misrepresentation, yes, they can be raised in arbitration because the arbitration would have that jurisdiction. And of course, I don't see why an employer and a pension fund can't agree to argue something in arbitration. But
Counsel, let me ask you, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you said something, when this was in the district court, did the fund say, Your Honor, you're precluded from deciding this issue about as soon as practicable because they waived their right to go to arbitration?
They did argue that we waived our right to a laches defense.
Right.
Because we did not initiate arbitration.
And that was that weird time when the role of pre-Allied payment, we didn't know where latches
okay.
fit in.
All right. They did raise the same issue they're raising now. Okay.
Yes. But so it was the latches defense. In full disclosure, we didn't, as Judge Phipps just meant, we didn't have the luxury of Allied at that time. So before the district, but they at no point did they move to dismiss, to compel arbitration. At no point did they argue that the judge has no jurisdiction at all, only to address the employer-employee status. And I think that is a big element as well. As long, in addition to the fact that the determination, in my opinion, and based upon the language of numerous precedent in this circuit, not the 8th or the 10th, in this circuit, employers cannot be compelled to arbitrate. So what is the pension fund saying? We are required to fight this on two fronts. RTI and IMI are required to initiate arbitration. But the law is clear. You cannot require an employer to arbitrate a dispute.
But isn't that, you know, the word I used earlier is, you know, prophylactic. It might just be a preservation sort of arbitration request. But isn't the answer you file that and say, hey, look, you know what, we don't think we belong here, and we're going to district court to get an answer to that. But we don't want to lose our rights. So it seems that what you're out is an extra arbitration demand. You preserve all your rights and you fight about employer status in the district courts.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. And maybe in some circumstances that might be the case, but just initiating arbitration in and of itself would be a violation, is not fair, is not according to the law. Because an employer should not, a non-employer cannot and should not be in arbitration. And I don't know if the pension fund would agree. I mean, you know, there's an argument that was made in the appellate briefs that all RTI and I might do is just simply write a one sentence letter and initiate arbitration, and then it just sits there on a shelf. That's not accurate. The regulations, there are deadlines. You need to initiate an arbitration. You need to select an arbitrator. There, and then there's a deadline in which the arbitration must take place. There's a deadline. There's all sorts of deadlines. Parties agree?
Would we draw a distinction between a situation where the issue of as soon as practicable is a really thorny actual problem as compared to one where it's really not a factual matter. You know, whatever the contention is, it's really, you know, doesn't amount to a hill of beans, as you will. Whereas, if the district court's confronted with something that's really a thorny issue about practicable, as soon as practicable, then it should go to the arbitrator, should do something like that?
No, Your Honor, because then I think that would reverse 30 years of precedent in which this circuit has said the what has to be an arbitration. I think if I remember correctly, I want to say Centra. Centra in 1992 said the technical provisions of how and when to assess withdrawal liability and the formulas for calculating. That's what is required to be an arbitration. That's it. Not every dispute, not any defense, only the technical requirements for how we get the money. And why? Because the arbitrator who is supposed to be experienced and intelligent to know these requirements, they're going to deal with the calculations of how much is going to be due and owing. Everything else can be in the district court. And whether it should or should not all depends on a variety of other issues, right?
And so, but, you know, let me just get in with this. Is, you know, it strikes me that it, at one level, order of operations is we got to know who the employer is. Because before we, whether we know someone's an employer, we don't have any arbitration. We don't even know if arbitration works. But it seems like when there's such a threshold issue as to who the employer would be, you know, sometimes what we do in those instances is we allow for tolling or something like this. But you didn't argue for tolling. I could see at least exploring the possibility of saying, hey, you're right, we didn't go to arbitration that time period because we didn't think we had to. But if it turns out that we are deemed an employer, then can't you toll the time that we would get for arbitration? You haven't pressed that point at all. And so it sounds like no, there's more rigid deadlines for when you have to go to arbitration, and you seem to stipulate or at least concede that they apply. I mean, a lot of this fight might go away if, you know, or be less big if on the back end you got told time and you could just say, well, you know, we'll press as soon as practicable in arbitration. What are your thoughts on tolling?
Sure, Your Honor. I will disagree. Respectfully disagree with the pension fund's attorney. I do believe that the lawsuit was filed in enough time, and there is no requirement in this circuit that an alleged employer needs to move or make a motion to stay arbitration. In fact, there's three different requirements that are done that are required. One, if they're actively misled, but also if the exact issue is raised but the incorrect forum. Because RTI and IMI initiated this lawsuit, if it turns out that it was in the incorrect forum, that's okay, because that does equitably toll. There does not need to be that second.
Are you sure about that? You normally have to raise in the wrong forum within the time period that it would have been due in the correct forum. And I'm not sure that you raised it in the correct in the time period for the correct forum. I don't think you can say we should have been in front of the arbitrator, but since we weren't, we can blow past the deadlines that would have applied. You typically have to act within those the time periods of the correct forum. That's wrong forum. I mean, wrong forum tolling isn't just you filed in the wrong place, you get a complete do-over. You're bound by some of the principles of the correct forum, right?
Well, and I don't have the case right in front of me, Your Honor, but there was not a requirement that they file a motion to stay or to toll. It was that they raised the claim in the wrong form. And by attacking the employer status, then we raise the issue. Because remember, it is not a defense. As soon as practicable, it's not a defense to be raised by the employer. It is an independent requirement.
Got it.
So we would not raise that initially.
So just to tease this out, if we were to say no, as soon as practical can't be decided by district court, right? You lose for purposes of today. Then if you initiate arbitration, it would fall to the fund then to say, hey, wait, this is too late. And then the arbitrator would decide that, and they balance that against the as soon as practicable determination, the element that you would be going. And so we'd kind of park all those timing issues in front of the arbitrator. Is that the plan B if you lose today, or is there something, or would you just say no, we give up on arbitration? No plan B. We've got plan A, and plan A is fight at trial to win the employer issue under alter ego and stuff like that.
It is, for two reasons, it is difficult to answer that question, Your Honor, for two reasons. Number one, we still have to determine employer status. Number two, if we are an employer, we are only successors and alter egos, and there is precedent that for successors and alter egos, they are not considered on notice until they are determined to be successors and alter egos. So all that would do, Your Honor, is cause more fights and more disputes. And maybe
in arbitration. But all in arbitration.
If you change it. Yes, if we are an employer, then yes, potentially, Your Honor, because that does not go into the calculation of withdrawal liability. So not necessarily arbitration, not necessarily. I think the issue here today is that there are no cases in this circuit in which the issue has to do with successors, alter egos, and as soon as practical.
Okay. I have nothing further. Do my colleagues have anything they'd like to ask before we hear 3 minutes of rebuttal?
I'm good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Your Honors.
Nothing further.
All right, Mr. Pepicelli.
Picking up where Mr. Magnelli left off, this court's decision in Dougherty, the 1994 decision in which the court did consider equitable tolling with respect to this particular Section 1401 deadline, did involve an alter ego claim, and it held that arbitration was required with respect to the alleged alter egos. Also, we sent this notice directly to the plaintiff in this case. That is undisputed from counterclaim and their answer to our counterclaim. And so they can't claim that this Barker and Williamson issue is distinct, because in Barker and Williamson, the issue was there constructive notice to somebody in the control group? That issue goes away if we send them a letter directly, which they did. This is actual notice. Separately, with respect to Dorns, that is the only case, as far as I am aware, that has ever carved out an exception for pure legal issues, right? If it's a pure legal question, this court in Dorns said that it was not an abuse of discretion for the district court to wade into that issue. But then in Coulter-Yon and Crown Cork and all these other cases, they have limited, in Flying Tiger, they have limited Dorn to its facts. They say it's a rare case in which there will be no factual issues. And you were right, Judge Rendell. This as soon as practical challenge is a factual issue. We cite cases in our reply brief, including the Eighth Circuit case from Vaughn that I mentioned earlier, where they say this is a factual defense that needs to be arbitrated. So for all of those reasons, none of those distinctions that Mr. Vannelli pointed to during his response really carry any weight. As far as the determination being limited to things that go to actuarial issues, I think we're talking past each other here. Judge Phipps, you had asked about, well, isn't that limited to calculational issues? And so the part that I was referring to was 1401A3A, which says, for purposes of any proceeding under this section, any determination made by a plan sponsor under sections 1381 through 1399 of this title and 1405 is presumed correct. So that recognizes that determinations made by the plan, not just determinations without regard to the plan. So the prior section of 1401A1 requiring arbitration for any determination, period, no matter who made it, either the plan or the employer, then that is subject to arbitration. But once we're in an arbitration, only the fund's determinations are the ones that are presumed correct. And that includes things way more than just calculational issues. So within that range of sections, 1383, a common dispute is not an issue in here, but a common dispute that we often face is whether or not somebody qualifies for the building construction industry exemption. That includes a substantially all test that we often fight about as to whether or not the employer's work.
Wouldn't your case be a lot easier if when you sent the notice and sent the demand, you also said, oh, we also determine that it's that we've done so as soon as practical, because then you would get the benefit of the 1401A3A reasonable and clearly erroneous standard? Or is your colleague says, do you think that that is just beyond that we've injected too much into the text and that the text isn't limited to that, or the text is limited to only notify, demand, and maybe assess?
Right. So the what has to be included in the assessment letter is what is provided in there, that we're notifying you that we have determined that you owe us withdrawal liability. Here's a payment schedule. The amount is this, and we demand payment in accordance with it. We don't have to say anything about it as practical. Yes, it's a timing requirement that we have to comply with, but they have a separate timing compliant requirement that they have to comply with if they want to initiate arbitration regarding it. And I'll just point out, I don't know if I made my point clearly, so I apologize if I'm repeating myself, but on September 24th, 2021, their request for review, they did not raise this issue, even though they clearly would have been able to raise it in their request for review. That's at Supplemental Appendix 18 through 20. They only raised calculational issues. And so they never demanded arbitration after we responded to their request for review. That response letter from November 24th, 2021, at Supplemental Appendix 21 through 23, that is the event that triggered the 60-day arbitration window. We can see from the Supplemental Appendix with the billing records of plaintiff's counsel that they looked at that letter the same day it came out. They had a conference call with their client, the plaintiff's owner, Eric Sobel, within a week, and they still laid low. They never tried to initiate arbitration. And so it wasn't until after we were sued and we sued them for delinquent payments, did they for the first time raise this as soon as practicable challenge. They hadn't raised it before. It wasn't an issue. So why would we initiate arbitration with respect to something they didn't even complain of to us?
Maybe it's because at the time it was viewed as an affirmative defense under latches. I mean, maybe it wasn't viewed as an element that you bore the burden of. I mean, I'm not trying. You asked a rhetorical question. Usually you ask a rhetorical question when it lands a blow, but I've got a few ready answers on behalf of your colleagues. So,
but the answer, I think, is that they don't want to be in arbitration. They wanted to just be in the district court, and it maybe that's judicial economy, but this court, as I've noted in the reply brief, has clearly said that, you know, arbitration in general is what promotes judicial economy. And even if this arbitration process does not further economy in any given case, that doesn't really matter because it still has to go to arbitration anyways.
All right. I have nothing further. Do my colleagues have anything further?
I have nothing.
I'm fine. Thank you. I'm okay.
Thank you very much for oral arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement.
Thank you.